What's distinctive or otherwise about the methodology of science? What are the characteristics of proper scientific explanation? Are there rational grounds for choice between competing theories? Is science to be understood in an instrumentalist or a realist way? What's the role, function and status of idealisation in scientific theorising? A book that I wrote on the pendulum in 2000 or so, what I was arguing there was that the whole distinctive nature of modern Newtonian, Galilean Newtonian science, the whole distinctive nature of it, in contrast to everything that went before, is that it accepted idealisation. It didn't consider the world just as the world appears. The scientific laws of Galileo, the pendulum laws, etc., were about ideal pendulums, in which you abstract from gross behaviours and talk about ideal behaviours. And the Aristotelians, of course, said, Galileo, when you've ceased to do physics, physics should be about how the world is. And Galileo, they said, you've ceased to do physics and you're now doing mathematics. And the whole achievement of Galileo was to bring mathematics and physics together. And the way he could bring mathematics and physics together was to adopt the process of idealisation. And without idealisation, you have no modern science. Well, it strikes me that idealisation, given its historic importance and its contemporary importance, should figure on any NOS list, but I don't think it should be an NOS list, it's just features of science. I won't, these you can look at in your own time. Let me perhaps just finish with an example. I've said one of the advantages of history and philosophy of science is that it allows integration both within a subject, science, and between subjects. And the book that I wrote, a book on the pendulum, and subsequently coordinated an international pendulum project, details of which are on a handout for you, in which there are 20-something contributions on philosophical, historical, educational, scientific perspectives of pendulum motion. And what I've said in my own studies is that if you teach scientific topics in a way that's informed by history and philosophy, you can get integration. You get a picture like the normal school day is broken into different subjects. Religion, history, science, philosophy, technology, commerce, economics, mathematics. They're all separate subjects. And within the subjects you get different topics. And standardly, for children at school, particularly high school children, the curriculum presents itself as, you know, 5, 6, 7, or 8 separate subjects that have got nothing to do with each other and whose teachers have nothing to do with each other. And within each subject, you have different topics, and frequently the topics have got nothing to do with each other. And children, you know, learn they learn topic 3 in science, and when it's examined, they, you know, tilt their head on its edge and pull it all out so that they can clear their head for learning the next topic. This is a very fragmented school experience. And what I've argued for the pendulum, and I have argued for another topic I'll deal with in a minute, photosynthesis, is that if they're taught in a way that's informed by history and philosophy, connections can be made. In the pendulum case, can be made with topics in history about, for instance, solving the longitude problem, solving the problems of navigation, allowing European trade expansion, conquest in far corners of the world, because Europeans, unlike anybody else, solved the longitude problem, and they solved the longitude problem because they understood the pendulum. Topics in religion, the pendulum, and the pendulum clock that flowed from it was a great boost for the understanding of the universe as clockwork, and in religion, that understanding of the universe as clockwork, of course, led straight away that if you have a clock, there has to be a clockmaker. If the universe is clockwork, there has to be a comparable maker of the universe. This, for some hundreds of years, sustained the design argument for the existence of God. The pendulum connects to topics in philosophy about experimentation and idealization, and connects to topics in technology, namely how you make clocks. And if the pendulum is taught by teachers who know something about the history of philosophy, then you might be able to coordinate with teachers of other subjects and have teachers of other subjects teach stuff in parallel to what you're teaching about the pendulum, and then you repeat that for other topics in philosophy. Let me just give you, I'll go on and come back. Sorry? More recently, I've done the same thing for the understanding of photosynthesis. I've been reading and writing a great deal over the last 5 years on Joseph Priestley, a man who I have great enthusiasm for, and Priestley's discovery of photosynthesis, and in fact an article on this topic of Priestley and Priestley worldviews and the discovery of photosynthesis is in this anthology on science and worldviews. And again, the same claim there, that if you teach the topic of photosynthesis in science, you can connect that to topics in religion, to topics in history, topics in philosophy, and again, topics in technology. And of course, this is an absolute, red hot topic now. Priestley wrote about the goodness of air, and some 2.5 hundred years later, everyone's concerned with the goodness of air, carbon capture, atmospheric warming, so on and so forth. And all of these things, of course, are connected to photosynthesis. Without photosynthesis, as Priestley pointed out, no one would be around to discuss anything, because we would have all long since ran out of oxygen. Well, just to come back, and let me finish with a demonstration which may or may not work. I gave a lecture in Istanbul, which I had a more sophisticated pendulum in Istanbul instead of a Yeltsin handy pocket knife. I had a large steel nut, and also had a bit of string, and we've made a mark on the string, and where I'm holding it, and hopefully more or less a bit less. What I'm wanting is for this to be a metre long, and I can see that it's a little bit off. Let me go up one fraction. We're talking very rough very rough and ready. And I declare that good enough. What we have here, from where I'm holding to roughly the centre of that, is 1 metre. So we have here a 1 metre pendulum. The next thing I'm going to do is let this pendulum swing for 20 swings and time it. So we need people who have got either a phone that can act as a stopwatch or also a watch that can act as a stopwatch. I didn't even try this earlier. This may be a great big disaster, but then again, in science classrooms, experiments never work anyway, so nothing unusual. Righto, what I'm going to do is pull this out and count to three, and when I count to three, I will release it so people timing set their timer off. Not now, this is just a demo. I will go one, two, three, and one swing, two swings, three swings until we get to 20, and then we stop. So this will be the real thing. One, two, three. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 40 seconds. Anyone else get 40? Miracle. Miracle. Here am I worrying. 40 seconds. Okay. 20 swings. So each swing took how many seconds?
2 seconds.
2 seconds. So each half swing out. Each half swing took 1 second. What we have here is, historically, one of the most important things in the whole history of science, namely, a seconds pendulum. The length of a seconds pendulum is 1 metre. Now, is this a big surprise? The length of a seconds pendulum is 1 metre. How surprising. Well, not a surprise at all, because Huygens, in 1673, who followed Galileo's work on the pendulum and built the first pendulum clock following Galileo's plans for the pendulum clock, Huygens realised that this pendulum can not only function in the clock, that is, each swing 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second, 1 second. Not only can you get the world's first accurate timekeeper, but you can get an international standard of length, which is natural. Because if you have a seconds pendulum, the length of the seconds pendulum in Paris will be the same as in London, the same as in Sydney, Australia, the same as in Beijing. You can take it anywhere, and you have a unit of length. This is an absolute marvellous proposal. And, of course, if you think about it, as Huygens did, if you have a unit of length, you've got a unit of mass. You can convert length into mass. Why? You just make a 10 centimetre cube and fill it with water, a litre, and you've got a kilogram. And a 10 centimetre cube, provided it's filled with rainwater, is going to weigh the same in Beijing, Paris, Sydney, anywhere else you go. So you've got an international standard of length and you've got an international standard of weight or mass. Marvellous innovation of weapons. It's a long and complex story that follows from it. But the reason for doing the experiment is that when you open a physics textbook, the first page on standards is standard of length, metre. Metre is the distance covered by some absolutely incomprehensible unit of time. By the length, the distance covered by light, or that light travels in some completely incomprehensible fraction of a second. That's what the metre is. Well, the metre's not that. Bit of a long story. The metre is the length of a second's pendulum. And that's why that incomprehensible length travel by light was made what it was, to accord with what you've all just seen in front of you. Well, what's the point of the example? The point of the example here is that, and much else can be done with the pendulum, I won't go into that because we're out of time, but the point of the example is that if teachers know something about the history of science, then a topic which is voted around the world as the most boring topic in all of physics, namely the pendulum, can be made really interesting. And that's the third point here, the pedagogical application of history and philosophy of science. It just makes classroom teaching more interesting and more engaging. And to come back then to where we started, how does this bear or not bear on constructivism? How it bears on constructivism is that unless teachers know, for instance, what I've just told you in very brief terms about the pendulum, unless teachers know that, they can't guide or direct their students to that understanding. And the idea that students can just somehow muck around and, you know, construct the seconds pendulum, this is just complete nonsense. They can't. They've got to be told that and directed that way by somebody who knows it. And in terms of teacher education, my view is, and this might sound a bit off the wall and extreme, my view is that you're better off teaching teachers about the history and philosophy of science than you are about teaching them about how children learn science. Let me, on that comment, conclude. The talk is a contribution of history and philosophy of science to science teaching. It's the kind of thing that the International History, Philosophy and Science Teaching Group, which has been around for about 20 years, sort of tries to encourage. There's a website, www.ihpst.org, in which we list out varied things. My own email is there. And if you want to make contact with me, please do email me and I can put you on our IHPST mail list. And our next group conference is occurring very close to here, Thessaloniki, the home of Ataturk. Thessaloniki next year in July. And if you can come, that would be marvellous. Thank you for your attention. And as mentioned, we have a coffee break, and after that I'm more than happy to deal with questions, but only really sort of easy, simple questions.
I would like to thank you, Michael, very much for this lecture. Now we have a 30-minute coffee break, and then we will be back to questions and answers. Dear colleagues, now we are going to have the second session, question and answer session. In this session, we would like you, when you ask a question, we would like you to let us know who you are and which institution you work, and then you can ask your questions. And so, yeah.
question or comment?
Hi, my name is Daria. I'm here in the university. My question is, what's your idea for post-structuralism if we just take it as painting possible to explain how people live? That is the art, the ontology part. Just think about the life. Yep. So do you still think that it is not arbitrary or?
A couple of replies here. The question is a common one. I recall many, many years ago talking at a conference in Australia, and I was talking sort of against constructivism at the time, and a leading Australian figure, a leading professor and well-known sort of constructivist writer, he said to me, Michael, he said, you take all the words too seriously. He said, we just write this stuff. We don't believe it. We're just interested in good education. We just write this stuff. We don't know what it means. We don't believe it. We're just interested in good education. He was being a little bit flippant. This wasn't his really deep-seated view, but it wasn't far from his deep-seated view. He thought constructivism just meant for better classrooms and more student engagement, and it was just sort of a way to get better learning going. And that it was, you know, really just a theory of learning and a little bit of advice about teaching, and all of the superstructure was just, you know, hand-waving that you could ignore. What do I make of that? A couple of things. The first one is that it leaves aside what to teach and how to structure what you teach. You've got to have a view about physics knowledge, chemistry knowledge, biology knowledge, mathematical knowledge, geometrical knowledge. You've got to have a view about that and, you know, how it's structured and what's primary and what's secondary and what's fundamental and what you have to learn first in order to learn something next, and so on. And one of the deficiencies of constructivism, if you just stay, you know, purely a constructivist and think that, you know, knowledge is just, you know, whatever sort of helps you get by or something, then it doesn't direct you to the structure of the discipline that you're teaching. It doesn't give you a sense of that structure, or it doesn't direct you to look at the structure and examine it. So constructivist pedagogy is frequently unstructured, and I think this is a really bad thing. My daughters had the misfortune in Australia, I have three daughters, and all three of them had the great misfortune in Australia of going to schools where the primary elementary school mathematics had been taken over by constructivists, and my three girls learnt no mathematics in primary school, partly because the mathematics program was just unstructured. The teachers didn't have any sense of the structure of mathematics and how to then lay it out and teach it accordingly. There were no textbooks. No textbooks. And I spoke to the school principal of the primary school about this, and the school principal said, we don't believe in the tyranny of textbooks. We're opposed to the tyranny of textbooks. Didn't want textbooks. So teachers were just, you know, preparing sheets bits of paper. And my girls had come home with bits of paper that, you know, was their homework or stuff. And this bit of paper for today had no connection with this bit of paper for yesterday. You know, this bit of paper had a circle on it and it was supposed to do something about a circle. And this bit of paper the next day had division on it, you know. So many apples among so many children, how many apples does each children get? The whole thing was uncoordinated. So my first point here is that constructivism as a teaching style, one of the problems I see is that it results in unstructured teaching, and I saw this in New Zealand. I've got into big arguments with constructivists in New Zealand, who in New Zealand took over, absolutely took over the education system in New Zealand in the 90s, early 90s. The program was just all unstructured. And in contrast, let me say, and I'll finish with this, in contrast, my wife and I simply emailed to Singapore and we got the Singapore maths texts. Year one, year two, year three, year four, year five, year six, primary school mathematics from Singapore. Every year had a separate text, and every text was absolutely wonderful. Little piecemeal steps, and you take a little piecemeal step, and then you practice, 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 and you take another little piecemeal step. So my wife and I taught our children mathematics through the Singapore textbook. And the Singapore people, pleasingly, have absolutely no idea about constructivism and would think that you're mad if you started, you know, talking constructivism. But children in Singapore learn maths because it's structured. And it's not, you know, they don't brainstorm two and two. You know, they don't have a role play on, you know, seven multiplied by three. They learn what seven multiplied by three is. So, you know, a long way of answering your... I've got nothing against lessons being interesting and engaging. Now, sure, lessons should be interesting and engaging, and that's what philosophy can do, and that's what history can do. Make some interesting and engaging. Now, the little pendulum example, hey, this is 1 meter long and it's a second. Figure that out. This is an accident. Kids can get interested in that. But if they're just, you know, brainstorming the pendulum, they can brainstorm all day and not learn anything. Sorry for going on about that.
This is from the university. My question is about Asian diversity. Do you consider that as constructivist? As an philosophical and from the philosophical viewpoint, is that because they are accepting the existence of environment?
Again, a good question. Listed on the slide, Piaget and Vygotsky as two of the sort of originators of constructivism, and constructivists frequently point to both and say, you know, our constructivism as a theory of learning comes from these people. But I think only in a qualified way are they really constructivists. Piaget's, one of Piaget's fundamental works is titled Epistemology and Psychology. Epistemology and Psychology. Piaget thought that his, you know, that his psychology was a contribution to philosophy. It wasn't just psychology. This was a contribution to philosophy. Vygotsky, with his notion of what does he call it? Distal, proximate, and zone of proximal development. Vygotsky is, as I am, clear that children have to learn the sort of language and the linguistics and the relationships of concepts that are outside of themselves. They come into contact with, you know, a pre-existing adult world of concepts and language and words and criteria and standards and definitions and so on and so forth, and they've got to make their own consciousness. The idea of education is to have their own consciousness accord with the distal zone, and that, you know, in as much as that's in some ways that's an anti-constructivist position. That's, you know, a more transmission of knowledge. You know, the knowledge is out there, and the kids have got to be introduced to that and have their own thoughts accord with it. An example that I have used is, for instance, playing chess. The kid can, you know, role play and brainstorm and, you know, do whatever about the rules of chess. This doesn't advance anything. The kid can't make up the rules of chess. The kid's got to be told that the rook can only move in straight lines. The knight can move in L lines. The queen can move diagonally. The kid's got to learn that. Got to be told that. They can't make it up. Now, once they're told it, and once they learn which way the rook moves and which way the pawn moves, then they can become better chess players. They can become better chess players by guidance and instruction and so on. But they can't themselves learn to be better chess players without guidance. And the more guidance, the better. So this is a case where, with, say, Vygotsky, the rules of chess are out there. And the kid has got to come to understand something which is out there and internalise something which is out there and be corrected. You know, if the kid thinks the rook can move diagonally, well, someone's got to tell him, sorry, it can't move diagonally. That's the rule of the game. And, you know, my own view is that there's a certain parallel with learning science. There are rules of the game, and you've got to learn the rules that are out there and the pre-existing. So the answer, Piaget and Vygotsky, yes, people do point to them as constructivists, but I'm more or less myself fairly, you know, easy. I can live with both Piaget and Vygotsky from a, you know, a realist perspective. And I'm, you know, I have to go back, and I taught courses on Piaget many, many years ago. I need to go back to chapter and verse, but when I was teaching on Piaget, I was quite comfortable about seeing Piaget as a philosophical realist.
From Basel University. Michael, you gave a quote from a colleague of yours who said, maybe you can bring that on the slide too. Things do not exist independently of observers. Remember the part?
Yes. Let's get it. Ontology
not one glasses film.
No.
You told me.
This one, yeah.
Yes.
John Slater. Right.
For constructivist observations, objects, events, data, flows, and theory do not exist independently of observers. Right. When I read this quote, I thought that the key word here is independently.
Right.
Because, like, for example, yesterday, I read on a newspaper site which said they discovered a new galaxy which is 9.6 billion light years away.
Uh-huh.
So for us now, that galaxy came into existence because we now have observation of it now. We have some it is another question whether or not it existed before we observed it. But I think here, I don't know what Stater said before and after, but I'm trying to interpret, and I want to know your comments on it. I think there might be two kinds of existences, like absolute existence and existence for us. And when we make observations, like for example, again about the same galaxy, its existence now will be different than its existence for us tomorrow, because we will have more evidence about its size, the number of stars in it, and the number of blah blah. And like the, you know what I mean? I'll be happy if you can.
Sure.
Speak more about that.
Yeah. As I said, John Slater is a nice guy and friend of mine for many years. He and I regularly have discussions every time we meet about religion. John is a devout Christian. I myself, after many years of being a Catholic Christian, am now a, you might say, devout atheist, and Stater tries to bring me back to Christianity, and I try to move him towards atheism. But we normally have this discussion over beers at meetings, and we get on very well. For constructivists, as Stater is, observations don't exist independently of observers. Well, that is straightforward. There can be no observations unless there's an observer. As I pointed out, objects, events, data, I'm prepared to say, depend on observers, because we, make the data, we draw the graphs and we fill in the spreadsheet, and the data depends on us, so that depends on observers. Laws, I'm a sort of a realist about laws. I think laws don't depend on observers, they're there to be discovered. Theory depends on observers. I'm happy, in fact, to argue for a realist view of theories. Once created, they exist out there. That's the view of Karl Popper. Marxism as an economic theory depended on Marx creating it, that once Marx creates Marxian economic theory, then the theory sort of exists out there independently of whether the Soviet Union or China is still Marxist. Freudian theory depends on Freud formulating it, but once he formulates it, then it sort of exists. The Popperian view is that it exists independently of Freud, or exists independently of anyone believing it. People may simply cease to be Freudians, but the theory still exists. But I'll leave that one aside. But objects and events, the realist view is, they exist independently of observers, objects and events. Now, Fabo is saying, well, you know, the long unknown star that whose light has only now reached us after travelling for, you know, billions and billions of light years, you know, all of a sudden, bang, it reaches our solar system. The realist would say that that star, it may no longer exist, you know, it may have had a burst of light that's now reached us and the star is completely blown up and ceased to exist. But the realist would say that that light was from an existing star, and the star's existence doesn't depend on us seeing the light. Yeah, that's a fundamental realist sort of intuition. And the same with events. So constructivists have other, I guess, intuitions on this, and myself, I think, Staver just got carried away here, you know, had a beer too many or something and started writing these things and didn't realise that he lumped observations and events together, observations, objects and events together. And you know, come back to what I said before, philosophers try to be careful about what they write. And if you're a philosopher and you write these things, you kind of think, oh, I've just said that objects and events in the same sentence as observations, you know, there's something different about them. You know, we've got here just a the lawful and certain nature of natural phenomena are properties of us, those who describe, not of nature that's described. Well, the realist, of course, would say that's absolutely fundamentally mistaken. That, you know, species have evolved in some way, and the realist view, you know, let's say a sort of a Darwinian or a, doesn't quite matter what you, what kind of a real, it can be a Lamarckian if you want, but the realist is going to say that, you know, over time, however it happened, species have evolved, changed, altered, adapted. And that has been going on for, you know, millions of years before anybody ever came around. You know, we arrived very late on the scene. But that process in nature doesn't depend on us. That's just out there and happened. And, you know, biologists and paleontologists and geologists and, you know, now geneticists and so on, they do their best to understand something which is outside of them. They're not creating what they come to know. They're not creating it. My realist intuitions on this are fairly deep-seated, but I can't but say that that's the diagram for Mario Bunge, that's the intuition that science needs. You know, science is very easy. Science would be really easy if you didn't have that realist intuition. You don't need laboratories or anything. You just sort of sit around and make things up, because as you make them up, they come into existence. So why bother, you know, drilling deep boreholes, you know, for a kilometre, 2-3 kilometres to find out stratigraphic profiles, you know, way down? Why bother doing that if you can just sit up on top and have a beer and, you know, make up a story and bring things into existence? And that's a bit, perhaps a little bit trite way to say it, but what I'm trying to say here is that unless you're a realist, why would you bother doing an investigation rather than just brainstorming and making up some story? Big issue. It's a big issue, and there are idealist philosophers around. You know, I don't want to say that there aren't idealist philosophers around. There are. And some of them are very knowledgeable and capable and so on. But I'm not one of them, and certainly lots of other people aren't idealist philosophers. But constructivists, once they get going, they very, very easily become idealist philosophers, as in John Staver. And the following slide was from Ros Dreiber, you know, who those comments that Ros Dreiber, that magnetic fields, genes, electron orbitals take on a reality as we make them up. Well, that's, I can't but say that that is absolutely fundamentally wrong. Absolutely fundamentally wrong. The theory of genes and the theory of orbitals, that depends on us, and it depends on, you know, being a good scientist and so on and so forth. That's entirely dependent on us. The theory depends on us, but not what the theory is referring to. That doesn't depend on us. Okay.
Ama hocam çevirde yardımcı olacağım. John Swaller'ın bir sözünden bahsetti. Konstruktivizm teori ile ilgili. Not only minimally guided learning in effective enhanced for some diye. Bir yansıma da konstruktivizmi benimseyen ülkeleri gösterdi. Ve bu ülkelerin hiçbirisi TIMSS, PISA gibi uluslararası seviye belirleme sınavlarının ilk 5 adı konumda değil. Yani Singapur'dan söz etti hocamız örneğin. Singapur bu sınavların son yapılan 3 sınavda özellikle ilk 5'te, ilk 3'te sürekli ve bunların ders içeriklerine, ders kitaplarına işte her şeye ulaşabiliyoruz. ve konstruktivizmle işlemediklerini görüyoruz. Sınav yapılarını da görebiliyoruz, soruları da görebiliyoruz. Sınav yapıları da konstruktivizme zıt yapıda değil. Yani burada bir sorun mu var, yoksa biz bir yerde bir yanlış mı yapıyoruz?
The question is, here's a list of countries. It's sort of growing, you might say, by the day. This list I made up now maybe a year or so ago, 2 years ago, but I'm sure many more countries have now joined it. Everyone is, you know, rushing to the constructivist bandwagon. And the question is, the countries that do well in all the international tests, PISA and TIMSS and so on, they're not on the list. Singapore's not on the list. Finland is not on the list. Presumably, whatever, Korea is not on the list. Japan is not on the list. This is not, you know, I say this is not my field of expertise. I don't follow this sort of comparative education literature, and I don't pay much attention to PISA and to TIMSS and stuff. I'm happy that other people pay attention to those things and make comment on them and stuff, but it's, you know, I've got other things to concern myself with, so I don't bother doing it. And I've never previously thought in terms of this question, but now the question is raised, put it fairly bluntly, the countries where children learn things aren't on the list. That is, the countries that aren't constructivist, children learn things. The countries that are constructivist, children don't learn things. That might be a bit harsh, but as I said, it's not my field. I don't, you know, pay all much attention to that, but I'm more or less happy to make that conclusion, you know, that conclusion that if you're a constructivist, you won't do friction. If you're a constructivist, you won't do well on international comparison tests. I'm happy to make that prediction. And as I said, the experience of my own children, who were taught, three girls taught mathematics through 6 years of primary school, ended up learning nothing. And the only reason that they ended up learning something is that they had educated parents who knew about Singapore and had enough money to go on the web and buy the Singapore maths books. And if we didn't buy the Singapore, if we didn't have money and if we didn't have education, then our children would still be floundering around in high school, unable to add up or divide. So, but I admit straight away that, you know, this is not my field, and people might say this is an inadequacy of the TIMS and the PISA tests, that they don't better test things that constructivists teach. You know, the children do learn certain things through constructivism, but the things they learn don't appear on the PISA and TIMS tests, and therefore the constructivist countries, you know, do badly. That's a big issue, and I really don't know much more than what I've already said. Thank you for the question.
Teaching about nature of science is getting very popular in our country, and more researchers are conducting research in this area. We are importing all these ideas, ideals, concepts, epistemology, philosophy, and trying to implement them in our educational system. Constructivism is a major basis of our science curricula. Yet all the ideas are originating from individualistic cultures, from the in the developed world. Yet our culture is collectivist, and we have lots of handicaps to implement all these ideals. Though there were no practical suggestions to philosophy and how to teach nature of science in the schools, I would like to ask, I would like to learn, what do you think, how would such inconsistencies between educational ideals and the educational context would bring, and how could such these constraints be solved?
Okay, thank you for the question. Let me begin an answer to the question. I'll perhaps make 2 points. The first point, as I've always maintained in my writing, is that you don't have to import philosophy from, you know, America or England, or nothing has to be imported into Turkey to have philosophy in the science classroom. Nor do we have to import anything into Australia or anywhere else? We don't have to wait for NOS to appear in the curriculum, in order to have philosophy. Any science textbook or science program or science teacher is going to use in their teaching, and children will learn about laws, explanations, causation, models, theory, evidence, confirmation, falsification, experiment, observation, etc. Science courses anywhere, Singapore, the Philippines, Japan, Australia, Thailand, Turkey, science courses have all got these words in them. And they had those words in them before any curriculum reform or before any NOS ever appeared or anything else. Well, philosophy begins when the student asks, what does explanation mean in science? Or when the student asks, one classic case, a student asked the teacher, said, are atoms red or green? Because in the chemistry book, the atoms are red. In the biology book, the atoms are green. Are atoms red or green? Well, the student is asking you a question about models. And my point here is simply that if teachers explain the terms that they use, then they're doing philosophy. What is confirmation? Once you start to explain to a kid what the confirmation of a theory is and how that differs from verification, then you're doing philosophy. And when you do philosophy, you're sort of, in a way, you're teaching about the nature of science. So the first point here is that the philosophy is already there. It just has to be recognised. And if a teacher, in response to students, says, I don't know what laws mean, I don't know what explanation means, I don't know what causation means, I don't know what models mean, I don't know what theory means, I don't know what evidence means, I don't know what confirmation means, I don't know what falsification means, I don't know what experiment means, I don't know what observation means, that teacher's not doing a very good job. The teacher's got to know something about these things. But knowing something about those things is knowing philosophy. And the more you know, the better you're going to be as a teacher. The first point I want to make is just that you don't have to wait for anything to be imported. The philosophy is already there. The second point about this nature of science stuff, I'm fairly relaxed about what we're trying to do in NOS teaching. I wrote and published a paper maybe 10 years ago. The title of it is Modest Goals. Having modest goals when teaching nature of science. And to cut a long story short, the point of that paper was that have modest goals. I think what I was saying is you've taught the nature of science well if you get kids interested in the question. Just get them interested. They don't have to learn the Lederman 7 or the Matthews or the McComas 10 or the Matthews 15. They don't have to learn any of that stuff. They just have to be interested in the questions. In the physics curriculum we say Newtonian mechanics, this object attracts that object, and the law is given by F equals Gn1m2 over R squared. Well, the beginning of NOS teaching is to try to get kids, how can this attract that at a distance without anything in between them? Get kids to think about that. How can it happen? We read that this attracts that at a distance. Instead of the kid learning F equals G and 1 M2 over R squared, work out what F is when, you know, G is this, M is that, M2 is something else and R is something else. You know, then work out what G is if you find that F is this when M is this and M2 is that and R is something else. Work out what R is if we find that, you know, F is this and M is this and M is something else and G is that. All of that is, you know, doing technical physics. And that's terrific. It doesn't do children any harm to do technical physics. And the astronaut man I read up, he did really wonderful technical physics. And he could work out all of those things. You know, he could work out what G was, you know, if you give him F and give him M1 and M2 and R squared, he could work it out in a flash. So it does no harm. But in terms of nature of science, my view is that it's more important to get kids interested in how can this happen? And that then, you know, is an opportunity to relive the historically important debates. The continental, as you know, people may or may not know, the continental opponents of Newton thought that he'd gone mad, in thinking that of attraction at a distance. There had to be something connecting this to that. And that as soon as you say that there's attraction without connection, then the continental physicists thought that Newton had lost his marbles. Well, you can relive those debates. So, in terms of, you know, teaching NOS and importing NOS stuff from, you know, the Letterman 7 or the McComas 10 or anywhere else, my view is that that's, it doesn't do any harm. Sorry, it does do harm if kids just learn that stuff as a catechism. If they learn it as a catechism, as if they're learning the Quran or learning the Bible or something. That does harm. They should be interested in the questions. And despite my having, you know, strong views about realism and rationality and so on, I absolutely acknowledge that there are many wonderful and fine and much more learned philosophers than me who aren't realists. Absolutely. Some of them I know are card-carrying idealists. And they're very bright and well-educated, thoughtful people. And so there's a whole range of opinions on these things. And I'm not, you know, wanting to say that this is the right and that's the wrong, much less having kids learn, you know, what's the right and wrong. Get them interested. Get them to try to think philosophically. Yeah. Hope that's some answer to your question.
So, I want to comment on the self-claimed constructivist features in those values and me making the Turkish curriculum here. I don't want you to get a wrong impression, because in the Turkish curriculum we have a structure for the content, and we also have guidance not only for teachers but for also textbook writers, for teachers, for kids, for parents, for policymakers. So it is not a totally out of the blue, you know, curriculum. So I think their idea of constructivism is somewhat or a lot different than ours. I don't know even if that is a true way of constructivism. I mean, I wouldn't suggest that to anyone. So that's one thing. And so I should stop.
Sure, thanks for that comment. And, you know, I'm sort of assumed that that's the case in Turkey, that there is curriculum structure and there is guidance and so on. The my only view here is that inasmuch as you're doing all of that, then you're departing from constructivist principles. And the constructivism part of it all, I think it's just a sort of an interference, just muddies the waters, and it confuses people. And some people might take the constructivist word seriously, and actually think, this means something. I better look up what constructivism means. And they look up constructivism on the internet and they see von Glasersfeld and Staper and people, and what does constructivism mean? It means that, the world sort of doesn't exist unless we think about it, and knowledge can't be transmitted, and so on. And that then can do damage in Turkey. The curriculum writers and textbook advisors and so on are giving guidance and stuff that's, I think terribly important. But all of that is simply, that doesn't sit too easily with constructivist principles. The view that children have to construct their own knowledge, that's simply wrong. Absolutely simply wrong. Children can be given knowledge. I asked a couple of minutes ago, I didn't know where the men's bathroom was. I asked, where's the men's bathroom? And I forget who, someone said, down the corridor and second door on the left. They gave me knowledge. I didn't have it. And I asked, and I was given it. Knowledge was transmitted. The kid learning chess. Oh, sir, can the rook move diagonally? No. The rook can't move diagonally. It can only move in straight lines. You give the kids knowledge of the world rules of chess. Like a kid learning to play soccer. I don't play soccer and I've never watched soccer. In my life, I've never seen a soccer game. I've seen it most on television, on the news, in my entire life, about 3 minutes of soccer. So I know nothing about soccer. But presumably, the kid who learns soccer, football, has got to be told what, I don't know what the rules are, but the kid's got to be told what the rules are. He can't make up the rules. You can't pick the ball up and run with it in soccer, Sorry, if you do that, you're playing rugby, you're not playing soccer. Oh, sorry, rugby. So, this, fundamental idea that kids have to construct their own knowledge, my response is, this is simply a mistake, an absolute mistake. They don't. They can be told things. Now, clearly, that they don't learn everything they're told, and that's what good pedagogy is about. That's what good guidance is about, for teachers to try to get situations in the classroom whereby, kids who are told things can learn what they're told. And that kids who are, given the rules can expand a bit on what they're doing. That's the absolute beauty of the Singapore Maths program. Absolute beauty of it. They're given little piece by piece by little piece, and then once they've got enough pieces, they can then make steps of their own. I won't go on any further on this. I believe in exciting and interesting and good student involvement in classrooms, but you can do all that without constructivism. Let me finish perhaps on this. I did have a slide and I took it out this morning of the presentation. There are lots of good things in constructivism. There are lots of good things in constructivism. My claim is that the good things have been known since ever. since ever. Socrates, in his kids, he asks the kids, what do you think justice is? What do you think goodness is? And the kids, you know, give an answer, and he finds out what the kid knows, you know. Constructivist principle number one, find out what the kid knows. Socrates, what do you think goodness is? The kid gives an answer, and Socrates then involves him in a dialogue. How do you think you can double the area of a garden square? How do you think you can do it? And the kid says, oh, double the length of the side. Right, double the length of the side, let's see what happens. You've got four times the area, so that doesn't work. Oh, maybe we should. Two-thirds the length of the side. Okay, let's do that, see what happens. Get kids to, you know, find out what they think, ask them questions. This is all good constructivist stuff. Respect students. Well, Socrates was doing this 2,500 years ago. There's nothing new in this. This is absolute old. You know, educators have known this since ever. So my view is that there are lots of good things in constructivism, and the good things, you know, we've known since ever. The new things in constructivism, the novel things in constructivism, are all simply wrong. That's my view. The good stuff we've known since ever, the new stuff is all wrong.
Our time is up, but before we finish, we can take these few words.
During the break, Michael asked me in the bathroom, I wasn't thirsty, if I knew he was going to quote, I would say, I'm sure the ladies' bathroom, so maybe he would construct the knowledge by himself. just a few words before finishing. I'd like to invite Professor Ahmed Ilan Shen here to give a small cultural artifact on behalf of our organizing committee to Michael, to remember Ankara, and to remember our university. Actually, the cultural artifact isn't made by Professor Ahmed, but it's made in his hometown.
This is absolutely lovely. I love this sort of handicraft, and my wife loves this on our wall in the kitchen. This will be a wonderful addition to our artifacts in our house. To go from the wonderful to the, you might say, absolutely dull and boring, can I reciprocate an artifact? A much less beautiful, a much more boring artifact that I would like to present. Please, I will make out the provide a list of references for these quotes which aren't there, and once that is sent, then you are welcome to have the PowerPoint.
Finally, I'd like to say thank you to our students, Hale, Sıla, Armağan, Gözde, Gökhan, and Süleyman for helping us. Thank you very much.